Welcome to the URJ's Parenting Podcast. This is Wendy Grinberg, Parenting Specialist, and today I'm speaking with Dr. Edward Hallowell. Dr. Hallowell is a child and adult psychiatrist and founder of the Hallowell Centers in Sudbury, Massachusetts and New York City. He is the author of 18 books on various psychological topics, including parenting, the childhood roots of happiness and life, and strategies for handling your fast-paced life. As Dr. Hallowell talks about the five steps in nurturing the attitudes that will yield a happy life, he describes excellent teaching that leads to a lifetime love of learning.
There are five steps. Number one is to connect. Number two is to play. Number three is to work and grapple. Number four is to progress, and number five is to gain recognition. And the first step is by far the most important. The connected child naturally goes to step two, which is to play. And by play, I simply mean imaginative engagement with any task. So the opposite of play is doing exactly what you're told. Well, that's unfortunately a lot of education these days. Education that lasts, education that changes your life for the better, education that begets a desire to learn forever, that is rooted in play, which is to say, not it's just what you do at recess, which is to say it's rooted in wondering. It's rooted in questioning. And the way to trigger play is simply to ask a question. How do we figure out the area of a square instead of saying memorize this formula for the area of a square? Or how do we figure out why Hamlet was so unhappy? What was going on with him instead of telling him, you know, Hamlet was upset because he was angry at his father or whatever your theory is. But to play, to wonder, you know, why, what happened with the Civil War? Why did that war occur? Instead of saying it occurred because of slavery or economic issues, you say, I wonder why brothers would fight brothers. Why would a country fight itself? And as you, if you learn that way, if you learn through wondering, if you learn through playing with ideas, you will not only remember it better, but you'll like it. You'll want to continue to do it. Well, then that leads to step three, which is practice, work. And work and practice that emerges out of play is work and practice that you want to do as opposed to be, you know, hounded and browbeaten into it. And as you practice and work at something, you naturally get better. That's step four, making progress. Well, making progress at something that is challenging, that matters to you, that is golden. That's really what builds confidence. Getting better at something that matters to you, that is challenging. That builds confidence, builds self-esteem, and it's also the greatest motivator that we've got. We tend to want to do what we're getting better at, but this step cuts both ways. If try as you might, you're not getting any better. Well, that's a demotivator, and that's a self-esteem breaker and a confidence buster. So what you want to do as a parent or a teacher or a coach is make sure you're setting each child up to make progress. They don't have to be number one. That's irrelevant. What they need to be doing is getting better at whatever the task is. And then as you get better, you naturally gain step five, which is recognition. Other people notice. They say, good job. Doesn't mean you win a prize. It just means someone notices that your hard work is paying off, that you're making progress. And the recognition that you get not only consolidates that confidence and self-esteem, but it connects you to the people recognizing. And that also is tremendously important, because that's really the root of moral behavior. Doing the right thing derives from a feeling of connection to the group, of ownership in the group. I don't want to vandalize the school because I'm part owner of the school. I care about the school. The school cares about me. Moral behavior really derives from a feeling of connection to the group, to the team, to the synagogue. Those five steps applied over time absolutely deliver the goods. They absolutely will maximize the chances that your child will grow up to be the kind of person you want him or her to be. And this process can happen so spontaneously. I often tell the story of my son Jack, who's now a 12th grader, when he was in fourth grade, he found a stray parakeet in our backyard and brought it inside and named it Paris. I don't know why. He just said, well, that's his name, like if they'd had a conversation. And we went down to Walgreens and bought a little cage, and I thought that would be the end of it. Well, no, Jack went to school, and he started talking to the shop instructor. And the shop instructor was one of these magical people who's always on the lookout for a kid with a twinkle, and they got talking about the bird. Well, the next thing I know, Jack's falling asleep one night, and he's got a big smile on his face. I say, why are you smiling, Jack? And he says, my bird cage. And a couple of months go by, and he one day says, Dad, you got to come to school and pick up the bird cage. I say, okay. And he says, and bring the Suburban.
Uh-oh.
You know, I can stand in this bird cage. It's the biggest bird cage I'd ever seen outside of a zoo. And probably the most important thing that happened to Jack that year, and you'll never see it on any transcript, but it sure is in the transcript of his soul. And you can see those five steps. He connected with the bird. He fell in love with the bird. And then he went to school, connected with the shop instructor, and the two of them started to play together. They started imagining bird cages, and the instructor did what the adult can do. The instructor said, think big, and expanded Jack's horizons of what a bird cage was. And next thing you know, he built this enormous bird cage. They practiced together. They worked together. Jack made progress at a task and gained recognition. And that building of that bird cage, you see, you build a few bird cages growing up, or the metaphoric equivalent, and you're hooked on life. Doesn't matter what your grades are, you're hooked on life. You want to keep doing it. When you conceive of something and make it come true, it's one thing to tell a kid to dream, but then to help that kid's dream come true. That's the difference between a cynic and a doer. You know, the cynic is someone whose dreams never come true. Well, you make a few dreams come true as a kid, as that shop instructor did with Jack in making that birdcage a reality. Then you are hooked on it. You want to do it for the rest of your life, and that's what successful, happy people do. That's the method that actually works, as opposed to just, you know, flogging kids to get into the best this and the best that. And this is what actually does produce the results as parents we all want.
I can see it with little kids, you know, just it seems so easy. Like, my son loves puzzles, and I know mm-hmm. some children love coloring, you know, and mm-hmm. that's something that they get better at each time, you know,
mm-hmm.
and they can see their finished product, or learning some physical skills like swimming or riding a bike. But that seems to be cut short so early with memorizing or learning, being able to achieve certain things.
Well, that's why you want to make sure you send them to the right school and make sure you preserve in their lives, you know, places for curiosity to rule. And, you know, don't let the people who have what I call attention surplus disorder take over. You still can create, as we've done with my three kids, a life of discovery and a life of exploration and a life of joy. It's right there for the taking.
Now, here's a challenge, though. I mean, kids go to Hebrew school or religious school for such a brief period of time during the week, usually, or on Sunday. And teachers, you know, still feel some sense of pressure to get kids to achieve on certain levels, you know, read without mistakes in Hebrew or learn certain facts about biblical stories or holidays. But it sounds like you're suggesting that in a short period of time, our time is better spent emphasizing other
attitudes. No, you can do just fine with a tough Hebrew teacher who wants you to get it all right. As a parent, you just want to say, okay, you know, Rabbi Shlomo, you know, is a really tough Hebrew teacher, and you got to work really hard to in his class. That's okay. You're going to have people like that in your life, and, you know, there's a good to be had from him. Just don't think, you know, your worth is defined by the grade you get in Hebrew.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you just help kids keep it in perspective. I'm in no way saying don't challenge kids. In fact, I love tough teachers. I don't think tough teachers are the best teachers. What you want to try to avoid are teachers who humiliate. And if you have a teacher who humiliates, then, you know, you really need to intervene with that teacher and say, cut it out. You know, this is damaging. Humiliation does nobody any good. High expectations and tough teachers are great. You know, I owe my life to tough teachers. They brought out the best in me. So I firmly believe in challenging kids. It's just you challenge them in a context of connection where they're not going to feel humiliated. And that's a very important distinction. I'm a big fan of challenging kids. I think when you challenge a kid, you're basically saying you can do more than you think you can. It's an expression of confidence and faith.
Thank you for listening to the Union for Reform Judaism's Parenting Podcast. Let us know what you think and find more parenting resources at urj.org/parents.